A very warm welcome to our today's episode on the Private Pilot Lounge. I'm Fritz, and if you are wondering why we are talking in English today, well, this mystery will be solved after the introduction.
Moin in der Privatpiloten Lounge. Der Podcast für die allgemeine Luftfahrt. Von und mit Johann und Fritz.
And that's me. Welcome. You're wondering why we are talking in English. Well, we do have an international guest from Great Britain. And we have met each other in April 2023 during the Aero Fair in Friedrichshafen. And we had a short interview with him, and today we like to talk with him more intensive concerning his work, about flying, concerning how honest should be a pilot while realizing mistakes, and how can I prevent these mistakes. He is 51 years old. He lives in the southern east part nearby London. He used to work as a journalist for the BBC. His hobbies are, of course, flying, his family, cycling and swimming, but now he's focused a little bit more on flying and taking care of his family, of course. He holds the PPL, a night rating. He's a class rating instructor, and he has a restricted instrument rating. A very warm welcome to our show, and thank you very much for being here today, the flying reporter, John Hunt.
Fritz, it's good to see you again. Thank you very much for inviting me on your podcast and for letting me conduct the interview in English, because I didn't study German at school, I'm afraid.
Well, we can do it in French if you like.
You could try. It will be a very short interview.
All right. Okay, so we do it in English. That's no problem, John. John, I would like to know for the first question, when did you start with your PPL?
Diese heutige Podcast-Folge wird euch präsentiert von pilotenbedarf.de. Einfach mal reinschauen.
Now, I think it was about 2013, so pretty much 10 years ago this year.
Yeah, absolutely. 10 years now.
Yeah.
As I said in the introduction, you are holding the restricted instrument rating. And I guess I remember one of your videos on YouTube that you are flying pretty often the en route instrument flying. How different is it to the German instrument rating? Or could you just explain the basics of the restricted instrument rating in Great Britain?
Yeah, I mean, the restricted instrument rating came about because of people getting into trouble in the UK, you know, VFR pilots getting into trouble with our climate, which is, you know, to some extent similar to yours, but probably a little bit worse. We are renowned for our cloudy, rainy days. And some of the organizations came up with the idea for the restricted instrument rating, which was essentially a very, very, very basic instrument course, but it allowed VFR pilots to get themselves out of trouble. You know, if they found themselves in IMC, they could legally fly that way, make an approach to land, and have a, you know, go back to their family, as opposed to getting into trouble, which you know we know lots of pilots do. And how it differs is it's a very basic amount of training. From the top of my head, it's something between 10 and 15 hours of flight training. So very, very short amount of practical training. There is a theoretical knowledge test, but it's very straightforward. And in terms of the privileges, it allows you to fly in IMC in class G, uncontrolled airspace, class D, and I think even class C, controlled airspace. It doesn't allow you to fly in class A airspace, of which, you know, we have a lot in the UK. So it does mean that you're flying usually, you know, at lower levels, not in the class A, of course. And you're pretty much flying like a VFR pilot, only in IMC. So you don't have the full support of the terminal controllers who are giving you headings and vectors. You're pretty much navigating as you are And so the workload actually is probably somewhat higher than if you were flying on a full instrument rating where you would be looked after and controlled by a radar controller. So I use it a lot because we all know, I think, that to keep your instrument skills fresh, you have to be doing it regularly. And I'd rather be flying, you know, reasonably frequently in IMC using that rating so that when I needed it, I'm fresh and I can fly it. And whilst it is technically a sort of get you out of trouble rating to help you if the worst happened, it is actually a very practical rating in the UK because the weather's so terrible. You know, you can reasonably set off on an IMC day and continue your journey. So a very effective rating, but very, very different and nothing like the full IR that you would be used to probably in Europe. And very much different from the IR in America as well.
Okay. And do you have to do a check flight every year or every 2 years with that restricted license as well?
Yeah, it's every 25 months. So you have to go and do a check ride every 25 months. And that involves having to do two approaches, one of them a non-precision approach, one of them a precision approach. Or should I say one a pilot interpreted approach and one okay. that's not pilot interpreted. And then you have to do the, you know, recovery from unusual attitudes, bad weather circuit. I'm trying to think what else consists of the test. I did mine a couple of months ago, my renewal. As I say, really, really useful. We can't use it. I mean, the key thing about it is we can't use it outside of the UK. So I could fly all the way to the French or German FIR boundary in IMC, but the moment I cross that boundary, I'm no longer legal in outside the UK. So, you know, it has its limitations, but, you know, a really, really useful thing to have in the toolbox.
Absolutely. And did I understand you correctly that you said you are allowed to fly departures and arrivals with that rating?
Yeah. So you can fly... Just thinking about departures, the only restriction on departures legally is the visibility minima. And they insist upon, with the restricted instrument rating, they insist upon having greater than 1,500 meters visibility, which is the same actually as the VFR minimum visibility. In terms of cloud-based, they don't specify a minimum cloud base for takeoff, but in a single engine aircraft, you know, I think most people would say it's bad practice to take off into cloud at 500 feet. You know, and my kind of rule of thumb is if the cloud base is below 1,000 feet on departure, I won't depart. So I look for 1,000 feet minima on departure. So yes, you can depart IFR. And then for the approach, you can fly the approaches down to the published minima. But they do recommend, because pilots with this rating are not trained to the same level as people with a full instrument rating, they do recommend that you add some additional height on your approach. I won't go into the details, but they add a margin that it's good practice to add to the published minima just to make sure that, you know, you're not going all the way down to the minima, and if you're not in good practice, it would be bad practice to fly all the way to the minima. You know, so that's they add a few extra safety guidance on the use of the rating.
Absolutely. I've seen some videos from you that you were in Yugoslavia with very critical circumstances. It was nearly IMC, and that makes no reason that you say you were not allowed to use your IMC restricted instrument rating. Have you thought about to brush it up to get the full IFR rating to fly in Europe legally?
Yeah, I mean, I'd really like to. Of course, that would require a lot of theoretical knowledge study if I was to do it under the European system. There is the competency-based instrument rating, which is probably the route that I would go down, which has a slightly shorter syllabus, but it's still going to require a lot of theoretical knowledge. And yes, it's something that I aspire to do, but at the moment I just don't have the time to study it, unfortunately.
I guess that's a very important point that you say, theoretical knowledge, and you have to sit down and learn by yourself. And time is very, very rare at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, with the work that I'm doing at the moment, it's kind of full on, and then I've got a family to look after as well. And yeah, it's there just isn't the time.
Absolutely.
At the moment to do absolutely. It. I did start studying the ATPLs about 8 years ago. But, you know, I just couldn't manage it with full-time work. It's a lot, and I don't know how people do it. I really don't, you know, anyone that's been through it, you know, congratulations and all credit to you, because it's jolly hard.
Absolutely. And we are talking about your channel a little bit later, because it's very time-consuming. John, I would like to know, the PPL, was it a childhood memory of you?
Not really. I had always been transfixed by broadcasting. Broadcasting was my thing. But I had quite a number of friends who were pilots or training to be pilots. And I found it fascinating. I never thought that that would be a career that was open to me, because I wasn't particularly good at mathematics. I wasn't particularly good at school. I didn't want to go to university. And so for all those reasons, I just assumed that I would never be able to learn to fly. So no, it wasn't a childhood ambition of mine. But I don't know, I suppose about 12 years ago, I discovered the flight simulator. You know, I discovered Microsoft Flight Simulator, and I can remember, you know, downloading it and thinking, this is incredible. Just incredible. It's so lifelike, so realistic. You know, even following the correct startup procedure for a 737, or, you know, managing the fuel calculations and all the procedures and checklists. There was something wonderful about doing that. And I found that sort of feeling has continued. You know, I eventually, when I left some work, I changed jobs, and my colleagues at my former workplace, because they knew I was doing a lot of flight simming, they bought me a flight experience flight. And of course, from that moment on, I decided I was going to learn to fly, and that's how it all began. But I think that what attracts me so much to, or what did attract me so much to flying and flight simming, was how so much different it was from my day-to-day work and my day-to-day life. You know, my job as a journalist and a television reporter was utterly chaotic. Yes, there were rules, but it was just very, very chaotic. It's all about luck rather than judgment. It's all about, you know, hard work rather than skill. And so to do something that required skill and training, and also was very rule-based and structured, was such a relief. You know, I used to go, you know, I'd go flying, and it was a relief to do something so completely different. And, you know, that's what first attracted me to it.
Okay. How long did it take you to get the PPL? Well, if you say you have it for 10 years now, I remember I was also an old guy when I get my PPL. And as older as you get, learning becomes difficult. Was it for you difficult to learn all the theoretic stuff?
I did find the theoretical knowledge hard to learn, but I don't think it was perhaps as hard as you might imagine it to be. The theoretical knowledge, I got into a system. I found a system that worked for me. And I suppose everyone does it differently. But for me, it was a case of reading the study book from cover to cover, completing you know, questions and seeing if I'd remembered the answers. Then I'd go back over the study books and brush up where I had shortcomings, do some more questions, and then take the exam and passed every one. So I didn't find the theoretical knowledge too hard. Yes, it's the boring part of the training and it takes time, but I was driven by this wonderful thing that I was doing, you know, the practical training and learning to fly, and I was going to do it. The motivation was there to get me through the theoretical knowledge. And then in terms of the practical training, so I was working more or less full time in a job at the time. I was part time, but they were long hours, and I would do my flight training on my day off in the week, and that took probably about 16, 17 months, so just, you know, a year and a half. And I did my test when I had been training for 72 hours. So quite, I think that's where perhaps you've seen my age play a part in the practical training. That took a bit longer than maybe somebody who's a lot younger than me.
Okay. Have you had any favorite themes during the theoretic time?
Gosh, I can't remember. I think perhaps, no, definitely not air law. Probably human factors, the medical side of it.
Yeah.
I don't know what category it is. It must be human factors, I think it's called, or human performance, I think is what it's called.
Yeah, that's an easy theoretical knowledge.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed it, you know, because I was genuinely learning something that was interesting, you know, as opposed to some abstract, you know, bit of law or whatever.
Yeah. Did you get your pilot license at the same home base where you are now based with Golf Bravo Mike India Victor?
No, I learned to fly at Biggin Hill, which is a fairly big South London airport. I was based there for a while, having got my license, but the airfield, it changed from an airfield that was friendly to general aviation light aircraft to one that wasn't. They focused on business aviation and gradually priced out light aircraft to a large extent. There is still a school at Biggin Hill, but as a private owner, it isn't a good place to be based, unless you're extremely rich and have lots of money.
Oh, I see. But you're not afraid to fly to controlled airfields in the United Kingdom?
No, I mean, Biggin Hill had full air traffic control, and I think that helped a lot familiarize me with flying in that environment. And, you know, if anything, I prefer to fly in a controlled environment to one that isn't. I quite often will fly through controlled airspace because it's a known environment. To some extent, it's safer, I feel, because of that known environment, the traffic information that's passed, you know, around the southeast of England, probably in the same way around many parts of Europe, you know, around the big cities, there's a lot of controlled airspace, and the uncontrolled airspace is very busy. So I very often, I'm quite happy flying through controlled airspace.
Okay.
And that comes naturally to me.
Okay, that answers my question, because I would like to know, do you like more the controlled airspaces or the uncontrolled airspaces and airfields? But you have already answered it to me.
Yeah, I mean, as time goes on, I'm visiting more and more smaller airstrips without any control at all. And it's very pleasurable. And I'm becoming more confident flying into airfields like that. And it does work very well. I think it just comes down to where you trained. And that usually is what you're strongest at doing initially.
Okay. We've already talked about it. You used to work as a journalist for the BBC. You quit your job as a journalist, and now you are a very famous influencer on YouTube with your channel, The Flying Reporter. When have you started to produce your own YouTube videos? Did you already do it during the time as a journalist, or was it a fixed idea?
Yeah, so I started uploading videos shortly after getting my license. And initially it was just to... Actually, do you know what? Initially, I was recording my flights for just for personal pleasure, to be able to relive the flight. You know, we spend a lot of money on flying, and sometimes it might only be 1 hour a month. And I liked to elongate that pleasure by watching the flight back and reliving it. And I sort of was watching other YouTubers who were flying and really enjoyed those videos. And I thought that I would, you know, do the same thing and upload my flights. So it started very organically. I didn't set out to be a YouTuber, but it was something that I used to take pleasure from. And it combined both of my pleasures, which was storytelling and broadcasting, with flying. And that's kind of how it came about. If I was starting again today, I would probably start with a fresh slate, and kind of have a vision for what the channel would be. But it's kind of organically turned into what it is now.
Okay. The videos you are producing are very professional. Well, you are a profession. Do you have any help with the post-production of the videos, or do you do it by yourself?
It's mostly by myself. So in post-production, which I think is what your question related to, I have on occasions, you know, involved colleagues and friends of mine who are picture editors who can put the films together. And it does save time, and that is where I need to get to eventually. It's obviously not cheap to do it that way. So as the channel grows, I hope to be able to outsource more of the post-production. It's quite difficult though, because the channel is all about me, and a lot of what comes through on the videos is kind of my style, is my style of writing, my style of presenting. And it is quite difficult to have someone else take that on and do the edit true to your style. So yes, I've experimented with it, and I think what I need to get, you know, ideally I'd find someone who is a fan of the channel or who knows the channel well. Eventually, you know, whoever edits for me would need to really understand the business, understand what I'm trying to do. You know, also a lot of, you know, most picture editors, in fact, all but one of the picture editors I've used are not in aviation at all. So they don't understand, you know, the significance of a particular section of flight. And so they're editing blind. So finding somebody who is an aviator, understands aviation, and is a picture editor is hard. And I think that will be the key for the success. So in terms of the filming, I occasionally bring in extra camera operators to come and work with me. If the videos require, you know, another person, particularly if I'm filming my training, if I'm, for example, doing my tailwheel conversion, which I did, I brought in another cameraman because all my attention is on the training. I can't be doing the job of a cameraman and also be trying to learn a new skill at the same time. So yeah, I bring in extra camera people now and then.
How do you prepare a video, or, well, better to say, a documentation? Because you're flying through Great Britain and you introduce different airfields. How do you prepare such a project? Because it's not just jumping into the aircraft, flying somewhere, and just having a word with the owner of the airfield. It's very professional. How do you prepare that?
So specifically with the aerodrome reviews that I do, which are kind of a video guide for pilots to airfields, initially I've got to find the airfield I'm going to visit and obtain their consent for me to come and do the review. I need their help. It's becoming a service now, which also requires them to exchange some compensation to me for coming and doing the airfield, not a lot of money. And so initially it will be approaching those airfields, seeing if they're interested, talking to them about what their priorities are. It might be that they are adjacent to controlled airspace and they have a lot of controlled airspace infringements, and they would like the video to help pilots understand that issue. It might be noise abatement, noise issues, and where to fly the circuit. Or it might just be hazards on the ground. It could be, you know, a large tree on short final that they want to highlight. So I find out what are the really sort of key problems that an airfield has and the difficulties that pilots have been having flying there. And then I will talk to them about all the airfield facilities and services, the businesses on site. I'll try and find out something unique about the airfield. What makes it special? What's quirky about it? What's going to be of interest to people? You know, if there's some kind of hidden feature of the airfield that no one knows about, I want to go and find that out. So there's a lot of research done. I mean, you know, that's, you know, a few meetings that I'll have with the airfield beforehand. Shortly before visiting the airfield, I write a rough script. It's sort of a script, but it's more of a storyboard in writing, which helps me focus on, when I come to film it, focus on what I need to do, what I need to say, what I need to film. So it's a filming brief, but it's scripted to some extent. So I've kind of got the story already in my head. And then I'll go and fly there and I'll conduct the filming and focus on what I've decided to focus on. I'll usually have written the pieces to camera, the presentations to camera. Sometimes I don't. I'll just do that, think about it on the day and just do it. But especially at this time of year, you know, with daylight being much shorter, there's a lot to get done in a day. So you have to be really focused. You can't just go along, pull the camera out and expect to have a successful shoot. You know, I need the airfield to help me with access to various things and people. There has to be a timeline of what we're going to film and when. So there's quite a lot to it.
It's a quite a lot of work, and I guess the people don't see it if you watch your videos on YouTube. A friend of mine, he told me for every flying minute he needs 1 hour work on the computer to cut it. Can you say how long do you need for the idea of a video until the first cut to the publishing on YouTube? How long does it take for you approximately?
Yeah, it's difficult to say because obviously the ideas are coming all the time and they can't be measured in hours or minutes really, because the idea is something that just comes up either through somebody contacting me with an idea or for me coming up with an idea of my own. So at home, I've got a big whiteboard and I literally just scribble on that. If I get an idea, it goes on the whiteboard. And so that's the kind of first stage. And we're talking here not necessarily about airfield reviews. We're talking about all sorts of videos here now. From that point, I suppose, if I think of a typical, I'm trying to think of, there's one video that I'm just finishing now, which is called, basically I subject myself to the skills test. So it's 10 years since I got my license. If I had to do my skills test again, would I pass? And so that's the concept. So that was the idea. Obviously I've made the arrangements with the flying school to do it, which didn't take very long, you know, a few phone calls, a few emails. We pick a day, the weather's good, we turn up, we go and do the flight. There was some discussion about, you know, what parts of the skills test are we going to do and which ones we won't cover in the film because time is limited. flying time is expensive. So we didn't do the full skills test because it's expected that I'm going to be able to land the airplane, right? You know, people have seen me do it thousands of times. We don't have to show that and we don't have to examine that. So the film, we did an hour and a half of filming. So that was, you know, that ends up being a day, really. By the time you've got there, you've filmed, you've come home. So that's a day of filming. And then the editing for that, well, I'm 2 days into editing that already, and probably have two more days left. So that film's going to take four days to edit. And every film is different. Every film, you know, you could edit some. I've edited films in less than a day. Some films take 7 days. You know, it depends how complex they are, how many different strands there are, how much footage there is from different angles and scenes. So there's no one clear answer, but I would say probably, if you know, the short answer to your question is somewhere between 3 and 9 days, maybe, is what we're talking for a film.
Where do you get your ideas from? Is it from the audience of YouTube? Is it your family's friends? Who gives you the idea for that lovely film?
It's all of that. I mean, it's everything. It's emails. You know, I had an email from a charity just recently who contacted me about the work that they do, which not many people know about. And I thought that was worth doing. So we're going to be filming next month on that. You know, I'll talk to my family and I'll say, you know, I really need to make a film that's something like this, or you know, what ideas, and they'll come up with ideas. You know, I had the idea of doing kind of Britain's, well, the initial idea was Britain's scariest runways, which I thought would be good, you know, doing a kind of a top 10. But I don't think the airfields themselves would be very happy about that. So I suppose I've made it, you know, I'm working on the concept of, you know, Britain's 10 most challenging airfields, or Britain's most interesting runways or interesting approaches, just to make it a little bit more acceptable. And yeah, so the ideas just sort of come out of nowhere sometimes, or, you know, you'll sit down and you'll think. So at the moment I'm thinking there's a lot of demand for, you know, people who are in training come to my videos to watch and learn. And now that I've established myself as a private pilot, you know, I don't do so much of the kind of basics anymore. And I think there probably is demand for a series of videos that just is back to basics. You know, it's just covering some of the basic stuff. And, you know, going through a PFL, doing some steep turns, doing a controlled airspace transit, filing a flight plan, just doing some of the basic stuff. So, you know, that's another idea. I'm giving you all my ideas here, Fritz. You know, somebody else will come on YouTube and make these videos, and that, you know, that's...
Yeah. You have to be very fast now. Very fast.
Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead, you do it, I don't mind.
So you see, you have a lot of tons of material what you can do in the next few films on YouTube. John, when we have met each other on the Aero Fair in Friedrichshafen, we talked also about the circumstances about honesty in your videos, because you show mistakes. Normally, we have already talked about it, pilots don't do any mistakes during flying, but you show your mistakes. What would you say is the most important fact that many pilots try to cover mistakes?
I think it's probably the reason why I think why pilots cover mistakes is out of embarrassment. It's also, I think, that there is a culture amongst pilots that you've got to be the best of the best to be a pilot. You can't be second best. And there's a lot of judgment in flying. You know, I see it in social media, I see it in the forums. You know, there's just some quite, to be quite frank, some of it's quite nasty. and unpleasant. And I think that means that pilots, therefore, are less likely to want to admit to making a mistake. I made a video just recently about a pilot who infringed Class A airspace by accident. It wasn't deliberate. And they happened to be a long-time follower of mine, and we talked about it. And I said, look, how about making a video about it? There's lots to learn from this person's experience. And so the pilot was quite nervous about potentially exposing himself on a YouTube video. And however, we agreed that we would do it very sensitively. It wasn't going to be sensational. We were going to, you know, the pilot would view the video before broadcast so that they could let me know if they were concerned about anything. So, you know, it was a really interesting video, and it went out and it's had, I don't know, 80,000 views, a very popular film. But on the pilot posted the video on one of the British forums on the internet. And straight away, the amount of unpleasantness that came his way from people who had not even taken the time to watch the video and didn't fully understand the situation, and gave him a lot of grief. And it's very unpleasant. Now, I've got to the point where I can cope with it. I didn't used to be able to, but, you know, this poor chap was facing quite a lot of abuse. Well, I wouldn't say abuse, but just unpleasantness, you know, a lot of disdain for what he'd done. And yet he was trying to share his experience with other people so that other people wouldn't make the same mistake. So I think it's shame. I think there's a culture in aviation, and, you know, there's a lot of arrogance in aviation. You know, people always think they're better than you. And I think it's a real shame, actually.
Well, would you say that accidents could be better prevented if pilots would be honestly admit their mistakes? If there would be more of such pilots as your friend?
So I think people do admit their mistakes. Sometimes, you know, under the cover of anonymity, which is absolutely fine. And we have things in the UK, we have something called CHIRP, which is I forget the name of it, but it's confidential, human, something, something, something. And basically it's pilots admitting their mistakes or admitting their failings. And it's done anonymously. And these newsletters come out every month or so, and pilots read them because we all learn from them. So yes, safety can be improved through people sharing their experiences. I read the MORs, the mandatory occurrence reports that you can get access to understand what's been happening, what mistakes people have made, what issues have occurred. You know, a lot of us read air accident investigation reports, all for the same reason. And all of those systems are there to improve safety. So without doubt, you know, people examining what they've done is a good way to improve safety, for sure.
We do have the AOPA safety letter as well. In Great Britain, you have it as well, of course, I think so. You have the FAA safety letter. Mm-hmm. I try to get it all the time when I'm over there in the United States. Well, people do talk about their mistakes, but how's the feedback from your audience on YouTube when you talk about mistakes? If you show your mistakes during a flight, well, not mistakes, but sometimes you get circumstances that you could come in trouble if you don't have a plan B. And how is the feedback from the audience? And how do you handle that feedback?
So I think in terms of the feedback, it sort of comes in different ways. You've got the group of people, your loyal supporters, who always have your back and will be very positive. You'll get people who have been through the same experience and who thank you for being honest about it, because it makes them feel as if they're human as well and they're not alone. Then you've got you know, the kind of people who I was just talking about, the arrogant sky gods. You know, they think they're the best and they just come in very rudely and scream at you in the comments, you know, you stupid person for doing this, you know, how have you even got a license, you know, if you can't even do this, or, you know, some of it is very direct and very rude. And that's just the nature of social media today. People just think they can just say what they like to you like that. And it's unpleasant and it's annoying. And it used to really upset me, and it would niggle away in the back of my mind, you know, and it affects my confidence, you know. But I've gradually kind of learned to, overcome it. In terms of how I present the videos, you know, I think very carefully about how this is, you know, what's the reaction going to be to this video? Is there going to, you know, you become quite attuned to the audience, and you become attuned to how they might react to things. And you can then perhaps, it's all about thinking ahead, you know, what questions are viewers going to have about this? What, you know, you kind of that can then, when you're making the video, you can maybe address those questions so that they don't become issues, you know, with the audience in the comments. By far, I suppose the most direct of all comments that I get come from mostly North American viewers, mainly because they find the way we fly in Europe very strange, because it's quite different. You know, the rules are different, and they can be very direct in the comments. You know, I do find that sometimes, you know, when a video sort of reaches a certain level and it's seen across the world, you know, the comments can sometimes become quite hurtful. But you just have a bit of a thick skin, really, and do your best to not get too upset by it.
Absolutely, because during your answer, I just have an example in mind. About your last video, you were flying in a controlled airspace and you came a little bit in trouble due to altitudes. The controller said not below 2,500 feet, but the other airspace was below 2,500 feet and you were waiting for the descent. And after that video, you were talked to a lady from ATC and explained with her together these difficult circumstances. How's the reaction from other people? Well, it's positive, but there are some arrogant pilots as well, that they are going to write you and say, oh, John, what are you doing there? Nobody is interested in. Or
so interestingly, with that video, the comments have been very moderate. And I think that's partly because I actually said in the video that I'm going to moderate the comments, and, you know, I want comments to be constructive and polite. And the reason I said that was not really for my benefit. It was for the benefit of the air traffic control team. And I could foresee people coming on and being quite rude about them. And since, you know, some of them I've come to know quite well over the years through flying through their airspace, I know that they didn't do anything wrong per se. Maybe they were a little bit behind, but they didn't break any rules. And I didn't want them to come against any harsh, unwarranted criticism. So I said I would moderate the comments, and I asked people to be polite and constructive. And everyone has been polite and constructive. And I haven't had to delete any comment. They've all been published. So a very straight, you know, a new novel situation there people have, because I asked people in the video, I said, what would you do? I elicited people's reactions. And yes, people have got strong opinions about what they would do differently. And that's fine. That's absolutely fine. You know, some people said, why on earth did you go through controlled airspace? You know, you could have gone around it and it would only have added 5 minutes or whatever. That's fine. It's a valid comment. Sometimes it can be framed in a rather harsh, direct way. And that can be a bit hurtful, but it's still a valid constructive comment. So yeah, as you say, very constructive, very polite comments on that video. And I think that was partly because I'd stated that that was what I was looking for. I wasn't looking for rudeness. So sometimes maybe you've just got to ask people to be kind.
Okay. We have these arrogance people. We have talked about it. On the other hand, we do have the authorities, of course. Mm. Do you think pilots would talk more honestly about their mistakes if they would know that there is no fine from the authorities?
I mean, obviously, there's got to be a line drawn somewhere. And, you know, there are rules and laws for a reason, and that's to keep us all safe. And, you know, if pilots are breaking rules and are flying unsafely, then clearly they should expect to come under scrutiny from the regulator. And so, whilst to my knowledge, in all of my flying, I've never broken a rule or committed some kind of failure that could have warranted any kind of investigation, I think, you know, to admit that to admit that you could have performed better on a flight is one thing. Admitting that you've just, I don't know, I'm trying to think of what the rule could be. That, let's say, for example, a pilot flew in IMC deliberately when they're a VFR only pilot, okay? And it can happen, it does happen inadvertently. We know it happens. But if a pilot is going out there and admitting that they do this all the time and they don't care about it, and they're putting that on YouTube, they can expect, I would have thought, the authorities to come to them and investigate them. I think if you've made such a terrible, terrible mistake, I wouldn't suggest that you post it on social media or on YouTube. I would suggest you take advice. You know, you go and take advice from someone. And, you know, if you have to admit your mistake officially through some kind of mandatory occurrence, then that's what has to happen. Because in aviation, we have a just culture where, you know, people aren't going out to punish you, as long as, you know, on the whole, as long as you're kind of seeking to improve yourself. But obviously kind of malicious acts of misconduct can't be tolerated. So I don't know if that answers your question. I mean, as I say, I've never, to my knowledge, ever flown in a way that was illegal. And the mistakes that I admit to are usually, you know, little shortcomings of performance that we all suffer from. If I was to make such a terrible, terrible mistake that could land me in the case of an investigation, then I would probably take advice. I probably wouldn't publish it on YouTube. There is a line, I think, to which people should share things publicly.
Okay. John, you have a YouTube, not a YouTube, yes, of course, you have a YouTube channel, but you have a podcast too. And I would like to talk a little bit about it. Or better to say, do you like to talk a little bit about your podcast? Because I think the format of your podcast is completely different from all these podcasts out there. But for me personally, it's brilliant.
So I don't know how recently you've listened to the podcast, but we started it in January 2023, and it had a format, as you described, which was made up of, you know, an interesting guest, and also we had an instructor feature where we would just cover some basic kind of flight training issue or questions. The feature was called Ask the Instructor. So the whole point of that part of the podcast was to kind of deal with things that people might not know or have not, you know, once you pass, you know, we all know when we get our license, we still carry on learning, and there's still so much to learn. So that podcast was trying to kind of deal with those kind of things. I launched that as I'm trying to remember how many months we did it, probably 5 months or 4 months or something of this podcast, or certainly we had a limited number of episodes. And, you know, with everything, with content creation, it's very, very time consuming and also expensive. And it wasn't possible to keep it going, you know, in that format because of the time involved. It's a format I want to bring back. I love podcasting. I know you do too.
Absolutely.
My background was in radio. I started my broadcasting career in radio as a presenter and a reporter. So I've got a huge fondness for podcasting, and so I'd like to return to that format. Right now, what we do with the podcast is it's my pilot briefing. So every month I produce a pilot briefing, which is pretty much directed mostly at the UK, and it deals with what's changed, what regulations have come into effect, what changes have been are being proposed with licensing, medicals, perhaps a pertinent air accident investigation report, or maybe the summary of AirProx findings. So every month, that's what we do now, is I publish the podcast, which is in effect a pilot briefing. So slightly different format to the way it started, but I hope to return to the original format at some point.
Okay. How do you find the ideas for the podcast, or better to say for the former episodes of the podcast? Was it completely different to YouTube?
I have to ask this
question, because I know your podcast and I know your YouTube channel, but our audience, they don't know, maybe they don't know each other.
So the podcast sort of came about as a result of, you know, an advisor to me saying, why don't you do a podcast? And I kind of thought for a minute about what reasons I might have for not doing one, and I couldn't find any. So I thought, well, I'll do a podcast then. And then I had to think about, how do I fit this into my schedule? How can I possibly make a podcast as well as producing weekly video content? So I suppose the way I saw it was that there would be some crossover between the video and the podcast. So there would be some similarities. Or so, for example, I had a video about seaplane flying, and I was able to record a separate interview with the seaplane instructor, which was able to delve quite a bit deeper than the video was able to do. So that was one aspect. The other ideas. Yeah, so quite a lot of them, I'm thinking back now, were crossovers from the video episodes. So that's where the ideas mostly came from. Going forward, I think this is the reason why the podcast hasn't continued to some extent, is that I actually need someone to research it for me. I need someone to find the guests, come up with the ideas, because I work pretty much 6-7 days a week as it is. And so, you know, at some point, I'll come to the point where I have the time or the money to invest in, you know, somebody to do some research for me, so I can bring back the format. All of this is very time consuming. I think your listeners probably don't appreciate the true extent of how much time you have to put into the work that you do, and it's really hard work. Actually, very hard to keep it going.
Okay. So you stop it for a while and just brush up the YouTube channel, and then we will see if the Flying Reporter podcast is going on then.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I still publish every month on the podcast, but as I say, it's more now a roundup of news and briefings rather than in the old format, you know, with the interesting guests.
Lovely. We will see. Cross fingers for the podcast.
I hope so.
John, YouTube has made you famous, well, in my personal opinion. Is it a blessing or and a curse for you?
Oh, it's fantastic. It really is. Because, how can I put this? I think as a pilot, you know, just flying on your own, I'm talking for me rather than for everyone. Personally, I used to feel quite insecure as a pilot, you know, a newly qualified pilot flying into airfields. You know, it's all very strange, lots of different people. And as I said, we've talked about this kind of arrogance, this judgment that there is out there quite often in how you've performed. You know, if you cut someone up in the circuit or, you know, I don't know, people can be quite nasty. And I was quite insecure about my flying. And so now it's the exact opposite, because I land at places and I don't have people judging me. I have people coming up and saying hello and telling me how much they enjoy the videos and wanting to take a photo. And it's really, really lovely. It just makes, it's a pleasure flying places. So it's not a curse at all. I don't want people to think that I've got this huge ego and I get some kind of strange buzz out of being famous. I don't. But it just makes me feel as if I'm welcomed wherever I go. And there's a lovely community of friends now, that where I land at places, there's always going to be a friend wherever I go who will come and say hello. And that's just wonderful. That's what makes it for me.
This is very interesting, because it brings me to my next question. Can you do a flight on a Sunday afternoon unrecognized?
Very rarely.
Okay.
Very rarely. Certainly in the UK. If I fly into Europe, it's slightly easier, obviously. Although we have been walking down the street in Gibraltar with the family, and somebody came up and said, "You're the flying reporter." And this was just in the street in Gibraltar. So that was quite strange. You know, I've had people stop me on the train platform in London, coming up and saying hello. And that's just, my family thinks it's very funny. They kind of joke with me about it, and say, you know, my son thinks I've got a big ego. He keeps, you know, ribbing me about the fact that I've got all these people, and he just sits there and laughs. You know, whenever anyone comes up to me, he laughs because he knows what's happening. And I say to him, "Well, what do you expect me to do? You know, do you expect me to tell them to go away? I don't want to talk to them." Of course, I'm going to talk to these people. You know, but yeah, it is quite fun.
Okay, so your son handled it. It's very cool.
It's cool, and he thinks it's funny, and likes to make a joke out of me. You know,
but is he
just thinks it's strange?
Is he already a little bit proud of his dad? It must be.
I think he is a little bit, just a little bit.
Just a little bit, 20%.
Yeah, yeah, a tiny bit. In fact, it turns out, and I just don't understand this, but his friends at school all subscribe to The Flying Reporter. They all follow me on Instagram. And so, he sometimes comes home and says, "Oh, you know, we're all playing The Flying Reporter YouTube video break time or something," which is just strange. You know, these are 16-year-old boys at school. They shouldn't be watching The Flying Reporter YouTube channel. It's quite odd.
Ah, it's cute. It's very cute.
Yeah.
How many hours are you airborne since you've created your channel? Because the channel can't live out flying, or?
How many hours flying have I done since starting? Yeah. Well, probably around 700 hours since I started the channel, maybe something like that.
Oh, wow!
Yeah. Is this flying time? Are we talking rather than YouTube time?
Yeah, flying time.
Flying time. So, total flying time in my logbook is around 800, I think, but probably 700 of that has been since starting YouTube, I would have thought.
We have already talked about it, but how is the response from the airfield when you ask for an introduction of their field? Because you have the documentation concerning the airfields, if they have an history. Have you also received a refusal that they say, "Well, we are not interested in to make a documentation about the airfields"?
Yeah. So it's interesting, you know, most airfield managers don't know me. Most don't know me. You know, their pilots know me, and maybe their operational staff know me, but the managers tend to be in their own worlds and they don't know me. So I have to introduce myself and explain who I am. I sometimes encourage them to talk to their head of training or people at the airfield to see if, you know, they might talk about me. Once you've overcome that issue, most people are quite happy for you to come and film their airfield. Of course, you know, they all want to showcase what they have to offer. I didn't have a refusal from anywhere until last week, actually. And I approached an airfield, I won't say where it is, and said I'd like to come and, well, in fact, a colleague of mine phoned the airfield and said, could we arrange a meeting to discuss making a video? And I got an email back saying, you know, that they'd spoken to people at the airfield and they didn't want me to come. I'd be welcome to fly there any time, but they didn't want me to come and film. And the reason was they're doing a lot of drone work, unmanned aerial system work, and I think they've got commercial interests there that they don't want exposed on YouTube, and so they had legitimate commercial reasons for me not to go. But it came as a surprise that they made that decision without really talking to me about it and not really thinking about it fully. But anyway, there we go. One refusal out of quite a number.
Okay, that's okay. That's okay. One refusal is absolutely acceptable.
Yeah.
John, you are familiar with AeroPS, with that payment system. How did you find AeroPS, or better to say, did AeroPS find you? Who found who?
I can't remember. I don't know if you've been told, but I don't remember how we came to know each other. I honestly don't know. I can only think that AeroPS must have contacted me, but I can't remember. I quickly fell in love with the system. I thought it's great. I mean, we all pay for our car parking on mobile phone apps. Why can't we pay for our aircraft parking and our aircraft landing fees on an app? It's just so much simpler and so much easier for airfields as well. You know, they don't have to have staff answering the phone or taking payments at a reception desk. So, yeah, I don't know how we came to know each other, but we've become good buddies.
Absolutely, absolutely. We've made some episodes already with Daniel and with Ralph, and they are very smart guys, and they are very happy to see us on the fair all the time, and they have always an open ear for us, and I like them very, very much. Do you see yourself as an ambassador of AeroPS in the United Kingdom?
Well, I think you introduced me back in at Aero Friedrichshafen as being an ambassador, and until that point I didn't really realize that I was, but it turns out that I probably am, and I suppose I do now say that I am. We're sort of trying to come to an arrangement where I can help the app grow in the UK. It's still not hasn't got a very strong presence in the UK. Many pilots want to use it, but the airfields are, some of them are reluctant to change. They want to keep doing it the way they've always done it. They may have commercial reasons for not wanting to change, but I suppose I am a bit of an ambassador for it, and I talk about it, you know, when I'm talking to airfields.
Okay. Is it difficult for you to convince small airfields to use AeroPS? You already said, well, it's other reasons, but is it very difficult?
Yeah, I think it's for a variety of reasons why some airfields don't want to use it. It could just be for commercial reasons. It just doesn't work for them commercially. It could be that they might see it as complicating the way that they operate. You know, some of our airfields simply might have an honesty box where you put in an envelope with your landing fee in a box. So I don't know. It's something I'm kind of beginning to, you know, understand as I talk to more airfields, why some of them don't want to do it. I think it's partly because it's something new and unknown, and they're not, you know, they're waiting. They would rather more people use it before they sign up. A lot of them can see the benefits of it. You know, I mean, it's for airfields, it's offering a new and modern service to their pilots. It also, streamlines the bookkeeping, and, you know, it enables, you know, the transactions to be reconciled. I mean, we're getting deep into the benefits of the product now, but, you know, it can save a lot of time for airfields. So this is what I say when I talk to the airfields. But I think it's an aversion to change. People just don't want to change, really, a lot of the time.
So they are a little bit scared of using AeroPS due to computer systems.
Yeah, I suppose they might have seen, you know, various companies come and go, you know, and they don't want to invest in something that they don't really know or haven't really heard of. So takes a bit of convincing.
John, the last sentences are yours. What do you like to tell the pilots out there, your audience, our audience?
I would just say, just be kind, you know, be nice people. And I think that's probably come across in what I've been talking about here. I think we can all be kinder to each other, be more accepting of each other, listen to each other, and be prepared to learn from each other rather than, you know, dismiss everyone as being less good than you. So that would be my final word, you know, just be kind.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
Pleasure. Nice talking to you.
Absolutely. Guys, if you like to learn more about the Flying Reporter, John Hunt, we will give you the link in our episode below on YouTube, on Instagram. We are going to link you his homepage, then you can have a look at it. Thank you very much for taking time for that episode. We do wish you all and your followers, you and your followers, always many happy landings, blue skies, take care, and we're looking forward to seeing you again. Bye-bye.
Das war wieder eine neue Folge der Privatpiloten-Lounge, der Podcast für die allgemeine Luftfahrt. Von und mit Johann und Fritz. Und wenn es euch gefallen hat, dann lasst den Jungs eine Bewertung auf iTunes da. Die freuen sich darüber. Bis bald!